Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm Will Arimus.
And I'm April Glazer. Hey, everyone. Welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We are recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, April 2nd.
On today's show, we're going to talk about YouTube's problems with misinformation, conspiracy theories, extremism, and how the video platform has reportedly spent the past several years downplaying and ignoring those problems. A new report from Bloomberg alleges that employees raised red flags internally, only to have them brushed aside by the company's executives.
After that, we'll talk to journalism professor Emily Bell about why tech companies are investing so much money in journalism, and more specifically, why they're starting to branch into local news.
And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best stuff we saw online this week. That's all coming up on If Then.
Okay, so before we get into the news, I have some kind of sad news to share, but I'm very excited also about the future for Will, and that is that Will is leaving If Then. This is his last episode. It's been so much fun to make this show with him, to learn along the way, but he's off to Medium. So please, please, please stay tuned in Will's world. Follow him on Twitter. Follow Medium publication. What is it called? 10, right?
Yeah, it's their new tech and science publication. It's called 10, and you can find it at 10.medium.com.
Yeah, Will's going to be writing for them, and that means he's not podcasting with me anymore. Going to miss you, Will.
Yeah, thanks, but I'm excited to see where you guys take the show. I know you have some really cool guest hosts lined up for the coming week. I have a feeling that you will take it to another level in my absence, but I've had so much fun learning to podcast and making the show with you. We both kind of learned on the job and learned from our listeners. Thank you to all our listeners for coming on the ride with us and for all the feedback. I look forward to seeing where it goes.
Right. And just as I think a very appropriate last show, let's talk about something we talk about all the time, which is how these platforms are moderating content. Specifically, though, we're going to start or actually talk rather about YouTube. YouTube recommends videos to people, kind of keeps them in a flow of continuously watching YouTube. And that's often been described as a rabbit hole effect because it tends to recommend extreme videos and kind of pushes people towards a more radical place than where they started. I know that I've seen this in my reporting, but there was a report in Bloomberg today that kind of went into detail about how YouTube ended up this way, or I guess what YouTube didn't do that allowed it to kind of end up this way. Maybe, Will, you can kind of describe what the report says and what we know now.
Yeah, so this is an in-depth report from Bloomberg by Mark Bergen. The headline is YouTube Executives Ignored Warnings, Letting Toxic Videos Run Rampant. You know, we've been talking for years, and we've talked a lot on this show about Facebook's problems with misinformation and with just all kinds of crap in your newsfeed, with Russians hacking the election, allegedly, with conspiracy theories, anti-vaccine stuff. And during all that time, YouTube has kind of kept its head down. It's often gotten a bit of a pass, at least relative to Facebook, for the way that its own algorithm can push people into extreme views, for the way it can convince people that the earth is flat and then that vaccines don't work and that Hillary Clinton has, you know, links to a CIA murder, all that kind of stuff. And the report says that actually YouTube employees have been raising the alarm internally for years. They've been saying, hey, look, all this stuff that Facebook's going through, we're going to be next if we don't get our house in order, if we don't start thinking about our responsibility for the stuff that our recommendation algorithm is putting in front of people and for the effects that's having on people and on society. And the report says that these warnings were basically ignored and that CEO Susan Wojcicki made it clear she didn't want to hear it, that YouTube didn't want to go down the path of trying to take responsibility for what people watched on its platform. A year ago in Austin at South by Southwest, she somewhat infamously compared YouTube to a library, said, you know, well, there's always controversies over what books are allowed. So now YouTube may be headed belatedly for the reckoning that Facebook has faced. And it was very interesting to see that the company hasn't learned from what Facebook has gone through or didn't think that it would be confronted with the same kind of scrutiny.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to me as somebody who kind of studies and follows how the far right has been operating online. I feel like for 2 years now, people have been trying to raise a fuss and really like point to YouTube as a place where people are getting increasingly radicalized and being served, you know, content that is full of hate and disinformation. And, you know, YouTube hasn't really responded as much as Facebook has. But, you know, these alt-right YouTube channels or whatever, they've been making a lot of money for a while, and YouTube has moved to demonetize some things, but it's certainly a longstanding haven for this stuff. And it's so interesting to me to hear that their strategy was really kind of growth over health.
Right, but they could have seen all these headlines about Facebook and all the societal ills that resulted from Facebook prioritizing growth and engagement above everything else and not done something about it. One of the many fascinating anecdotes from the Bloomberg story is that YouTube's lawyers apparently would verbally advise YouTube employees to avoid searching on their own for questionable videos, so like a viral hoax or lies about right. political figures, because they said if YouTube knew that this stuff existed on its platform, then it could be in legal jeopardy. So they actually actively advised their employees just to like not look or not pay attention to the misinformation, the hoaxes, the dangerous stuff that was circulating on YouTube.
I mean, PewDiePie, or however you say his name, he's the most popular YouTube channel, I believe, or, you know, has one of the most popular, and he rubs shoulders regularly with hate groups and the far right. And it was just in December that I reported that when you search on YouTube, which is the most popular search engine, I think, in the world, and YouTube has said this multiple times, that when you search for the word abortion to ostensibly get information about that, the top results over and over again, like the, you know, for most of the results that you got and the top ones, the majority, all of them really, except for I think one or two, I'd have to go back, were about, they were very anti-abortion. And they were like kind of advising women not to get abortions, trying to skew people who were trying to learn about this. And so just if the most popular stuff on the platform is this, it's of course they knew it.
Right. And what this report suggests is that they sort of knew it, but they didn't want to know it. And so they intentionally looked the other way as sort of a matter of institutional policy.
Okay, well, this is something that, you know, I will obviously continue to follow because, you know, what YouTube shows people really matters. They have made some improvements, particularly around breaking news when you search for a thing, but that came after journalism. You know, I know that I reported and broke a story on after, you know, tragic events, you know, YouTube was just showing random misinformation. So we'll see if stuff changes after this particularly galling report. Who knows? I mean, they definitely have responded to journalism in the past.
All right. After the break, we're going to have our interview with Emily Bell. She's a journalism professor and an expert on the collision between technology and the media.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Our guest today is Emily Bell. She's the director at the Tau Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia Journalism School. She's also the former editor-in-chief for The Guardian's websites, and she's now a columnist at The Guardian. She's also a regular contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Emily Bell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's jump into sort of the lay of the land. When we talk about local news and technology, what has tech done to the local news industry, and why are big tech companies like Facebook and Google now trying to get involved in it?
Well, so good question. What has technology done to local news? You know, maybe it's slightly overdramatic to say it's completely destroyed it. But I don't think so. If you look at what's actually happened, particularly in American local news over the last two decades, there was a decline anyway, but there's been this real acceleration in the last 5 years. And that's because it's not just the case that people are not reading printed papers anymore. It's that the advertising dollars, which completely underpinned most local news organizations, have just gone. And where they've gone to is principally Google and Facebook. Now, I don't think that this was a consequence that Google or Facebook set out to create. It's just been probably the most unfortunate consequence of having a better ad product than legacy media organizations. So that's a very brief background. What's happened is you now have this, litigation of what does the public sphere look like now and who's in charge of it and who controls it, between a bunch of legacy companies who, you know, we know as publishers, we think of them as publishers, and then the platform companies and the search engines, who've always said, we don't really have much to do with the generation of the kinds of content or the production of journalism. Unfortunately, that position's never really been true. So in the absence of a model that works for local news and in the presence of exceedingly rich companies that are, if you like, sort of creating a void in local news, you've got this, it's not just a guilt factor, I think, on the part of the larger platforms. It's also pressure from certainly in Europe, regulators, certainly everywhere else, publishing companies as well.
Right. So now we have the news, which you wrote about last week in Columbia Journalism Review, that Google is partnering with the news company McClatchy to fund three local news entities. Those are new news outlets in communities of less than 500,000 people. There was also more news this week where Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg revealed that the company is thinking of paying news organizations to produce what it calls high quality news content, and it might put that in a special tab of the Facebook news feed, I guess, to distinguish it from all the low quality content you get in your normal news feed. Right. So what's up with these tech companies? Can they actually make a positive difference? Can they help repair some of the damage that their business models have inadvertently done?
Well, it's kind of like one of those things where you get, you know, if a bull comes into a China shop and it breaks everything, and then the bull tries to put it back together, that's not an ideal situation. So what you have here are both Facebook and Google, independently of each other, but clearly in competition of some sort, both saying that they will spend $300 million each on local journalism over the next 3 years through various different initiatives. And, you know, yes, it is better that local journalism has money than not. Yes, I think that there is a principle here that says, even though these might not be, it might not be the fault of technology companies, they are the people with the money, and they have caused this deficit to some extent in local news. So yeah, they should pay. Should they be the ones directly paying and controlling what news looks like? I feel very uneasy about that, and I don't really think that they should be. I think that they should be taxed, or they should be paying into some kind of separate entity which can then refund parts of the news ecosystem.
You mentioned there that there's a relationship between controlling and funding these kinds of news initiatives. And with that, I want to get into the various incentives that the kind of different parties that we're talking about here have. So, like, what good is it for Google and Facebook to invest in saving local news? I mean, is this really going to make them more money? Is this going to be a PR hack for them? You know, I can see why it would help local newsrooms that are, like, incredibly struggling to hire journalists or to keep journalists hired at all or to keep their doors open and keep publishing. You know, they need the money.
Sure.
But it seems like there's a real mix of incentives here. I don't know how it will even benefit Google and Facebook to do this. It seems like they're just being nice.
Yeah, so first of all, I don't think they're just being nice. That's one thing to say. But you're right. So let's assume just for 2 seconds we're not profound cynics about this. And said, you know, what is, I know, imagine yourself in that situation. There is an incentive in a way for particularly technology platforms that rely on people's attention and time being spent on them, to have an information environment that is not completely screwed up. Now, we know that now because over the past, 5 to 10 years, these companies have been largely allowing information environments to become incredibly screwed up. And what that's left, what that has led to principally is a threat of regulation. So if we move from the non-cynical, hey, they're doing this because they want to do good and they want to rebuild something that they are close to, which is, high quality information, things that people can share, things that people can read. We move slightly more into the realistic/cynical arena and say, we've got an election coming up in 2020 for the first time. There was a Pew survey the other day that was said that people are concerned about privacy and data. They're concerned about fake news. They're concerned about all sorts of things and the power of platforms. We also have a candidate, Elizabeth Warren, who has a pretty credible and very detailed plan for how she would regulate platforms. And there's a growing lobby around the idea that they should be regulated in terms of antitrust, in other words, just broken up. So is it coincidental that the companies are spending money on this right now? I don't think it is coincidental. I think it is entirely an agenda driven by the public pressure and the political pressure to change something before they get regulated. And Mark Zuckerberg's been on his, hey, everybody, we should be regulated tour this week, which is also a weird thing to perceive. But it's just showing how heightened the sense of kind of alarm is within these companies about what might be coming down the pipe from lawmakers.
And as you mentioned in your recent article for the Columbia Journalism Review, Do Technology Companies Care About Journalism? An effort to fund local news in Europe that's very similar to what's happening in the U.S. from Google now was actually came out of the marketing budget, which was essentially kind of lobbying money from the company.
Yeah, so I was in Europe in 2015 when the Google DNI set up, and I did actually ask somebody who's no longer with the company, but at the time was actually very instrumental. I said, well, where is this being funded from? And he said, well, it's being funded from the marketing budget, because we do see this as being a response to the way that we are being lobbied at. Now, I would give the company some credit for thinking, that they have to have a relationship with journalism, and they would rather have a robust one and one that's sincere and informed rather than one that is completely random and damaging. And Google has been on this track much longer than Facebook has. So if you imagine, Google News was invented in 2002, or that's when it was, launched on the world. I was running the newsroom at The Guardian, the online newsroom then. We used to talk to Google all the time about how we could optimize search engine optimization. How can we optimize our stories to be seen in things like Google News? So they've always had this relationship with talking to newsrooms about how we should change our journalism so it could fit in with or be seen by these platforms that, have much bigger audiences than we would have as individual publishers. So there is a relationship there that they want to build on. The question about whether or not they are the right people to do it and whether it's healthy, I think is, a separate one. And it still makes me feel really not particularly confident to look at the priorities of companies like Apple, because Apple we had Tim Cook talking about, here's Apple News Plus, I love quality journalism, I want you to be able to access all of this quality journalism. Journalism is being bandied around. You would think, honestly, from the outside, it was the only thing these companies were worrying about. And it really isn't, that's the thing. It's actually a tiny concern to them in the overall firmament of their much larger businesses.
And so, you know, one thing I'm concerned about with this, and I didn't mean to sound so, so cynical. It's just I'm so worried about the state of local news.
It's fine to be really cynical.
I realize the amount of power that they have. What are your thoughts then on the ability for news organizations to retain editorial sovereignty with an investor like Google and Facebook? I mean, we're talking about two of the most powerful companies in the world. So, you know, this money isn't coming from nowhere.
Sure. Well, you know, at the moment, it's a really small amount of funding. That's the other thing. Let's not get carried away about how money they are lavishing on the news sector. But it's weird. We've studied this for the last 5 years at the Tao Center, and we speak a lot to people within publishing companies who deal with the platforms and also with platform people who are dealing with publishers. And how that kind of symbiotic relationship changes the power dynamic is really interesting. So, you know, kind of development and innovation within news organizations has, I think, been completely changed by, say, the presence of Google money. So on the one hand, they will say, virtual reality is the next big thing, or pivot to video being the most obvious example of this. And newsrooms change their structure, they change their innovation budgets, they change their editorial staff, and then the platforms just change their minds. So at local level, this idea of sort of having an algorithm, whether your sovereign owner is the algorithm that you're trying to get to recognize your work and show it to a readership, or whether it's this theoretical kind of stream of revenue that you'll get from this, you know, amazingly rich and, beneficent patron, it changes the orientation of the journalism. And my worry is that, you know, that independence is pretty fragile. And I think we're in danger, particularly in the US, of saying, hey, you know what, we haven't really figured out civic media and we don't fund public media particularly well. And a lot of it is very antediluvian. If the tech companies are going to move into this space without us having a proper conversation about what we want the civic media to look like, that's fine. And I think it's absolutely not fine. I think that there is no way that a company like Google, which is also, it has contracts with the government, you know, it has contracts with local government, it has self-driving cars it wants to put on the roads. These are not the companies. It's buying up property, you know, around the country. It's had fiber experiments in cities. These people should be being investigated by local news. They should not be the platform on which it is dependent. And I think that is a looming problem for us as journalists, because we can very easily get addicted to the money.
So I want to talk about solutions, because we've heard a lot of kind of diagnoses. Local news, you know, cannot sustain itself. Some may say that's because of a lack of innovation from newsrooms for a long time. Some may point to the current internet ecosystem. Some may say it's a mix. Whatever the cause, we need to do something about it, because stuff isn't getting reported and journalists aren't employed as much as they should be. And as a result, democracy suffers, right? We all suffer. And so, you know, you've talked about the idea of an endowment, which would be kind of a step back from kind of direct funding from companies. You also discussed civic media, and that, you know, would mean like kind of public media or community media, kind of corporation for public broadcasting type stuff, I imagine. But just a way to kind of have municipal newsrooms. Can you talk us through some of these solutions that you've thought about? Because you're one of the few people that's actually thought about what we can do about this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that, you know, America is not particularly well served by the fact it's one of the few places that hasn't had to think through, or just has chosen not to think through, having public media as a really significant part of the market. So where I come from in the UK, I would say the BBC is roughly about 30% of the media market. Lots of people think that's not very healthy. But on the other hand, you have these pre-existing funded organizations, which theoretically you could actually get to innovate in market, to create new models, to support an ecosystem when it's trying to get from place A to place B. So when I was talking about an endowment that the tech companies paid into, it could be, you know, what they call hypothecated taxation, whereas you take a small percentage of the tax that you charge these companies and put it into, you know, an isolated fund that would work to support media, which is basically non-profit. It's aimed at reporting on your local council or local city hall. You know, it has that function where it tells you if your water is clean, if your schools are kind of running properly, all of that kind of stuff. And the funding mechanisms for that, the problem is that there's no really sort of established precedent for how you would handle those funds, who would get to decide where they were distributed. But the principle is not that complicated. You know, the second part of this is whether or not there's any political will in America to create a much stronger and more independent public or civic media, because, you know, America's culturally very different to Europe. You know, you guys do not like government interference in your press. In fact, you have it specifically sort of, if you like, the First Amendment certainly works against the idea that you would pass a law that in some way sort of changes or restricts speech. But there's nothing to say that you can't support, you can't make a positive intervention in the market. So some kind of New Deal, I mean, you know, New Deal's very fashionable at the moment. We have AOC with her Green New Deal. You know, where is the New yes. Deal? Where is the New Deal for civic media? You know, where is the New Deal that says if you want to start a small community newsroom, or if you want to start actually kind of, you know, a statewide network, that there would be some way of funding it, administering it, some kind of funding for innovation. None of that exists at the moment. It's a lot of it is left to local NPR stations, which actually have been pretty innovative. That feels to me just like a fundamental problem when you have such an unstable commercial environment. And I would say, you know, everything we've seen from Facebook, certainly, and increasingly, you know, from Google and YouTube, is that we don't have a stable information environment at the moment.
No, sustainability is really key here. Just to give a personal reflection on this, I worked with a group of people for many years to pass a law. We actually passed a law in 2011 that allocated all unused FM spectrum for local community stations. It was the largest expansion of community radio in U.S. history. These stations are now going on the air, and they have no money. And they're not allowed to have they're not allowed to have advertising because they're community licensed, so they have to get local underwriting, and it just seems like we're structurally set up in such a way so that there's just no way for hyper local newsrooms to establish themselves. and I've just worked on this for so long.
So first off, you did God's work there, which is some of these can be structural interventions. You know, like, if we think about the current environment and we think about the platforms, you know, the one thing they do not do at the moment is make it possible to make a living from reporting high quality news on their platforms. And part of that is actually just fundamental design flaws. You know, the things that are prioritized on platforms are interesting viral content. They return more money, and the cost of creating the product is not taken into account in the platform design. When you have Mark Zuckerberg this week saying, we should maybe be funding high quality journalism directly, it's like, why don't you just change your platform so that if people are doing good work, they get paid for it? You know, that's a design problem. It's not a question of him kind of being, you know, picking people out of lineup and saying, yeah, I'll have that article up, because they don't know. They are not journalists. They don't really know what they're doing in this arena. And so I think your point about, you know, as I say, doing amazing work with Spectrum, those are the kinds of things we have to do, but then we have to have the funding as well. You can't just, as you say, have a system of distribution that you don't then pay creators and reporters for. Paying reporters is what this is all about. You know, it's like you have to pay people to go out and report.
Right. And I liked what you said earlier about how it's like the algorithm was controlling journalism. It reminded me of our interview last week about how gig economy workers are in some sense, their boss is an algorithm. The media, in some sense, their boss has been an algorithm, at least in online media, at least in the advertising-supported online media sector over the past few years. There are a couple things we've touched on that are initiatives by some of these big tech platforms to try to make journalism more viable there. One of them is Facebook has a product called Today In. It's like a Today In local news, and it's supposed to show you a cluster of stories from your area when you log into Facebook from local publications. It built that and started testing it, and then found that in a bunch of regions around the United States, there isn't enough local journalism even being produced to support that right. feature. These are called news deserts. Facebook more recently has come up with a plan to pay some publishers to produce content that might go in a different tab. We've heard a lot about Apple News developing this product called Apple News Plus, where you pay Apple a monthly fee and then it divides the revenues among 300 different magazines. Do any of those initiatives seem to you to hold significant promise in terms of creating a better news environment?
I mean, you know, I don't want to say it is a bad idea that all of these companies are thinking one way or another about the quality of the work that's on their platforms or what people are reading and consuming and whether, in fact, it's actually, you know, a sustainable. And I think that that's a good thing. I don't think any one of those initiatives holds enough promise for us to really start to kind of figure what we're doing. And I think that's a problem, which is, you know, we're right at the beginning of a really, I think, long and difficult period of understanding that the information environment that we live in has been created very rapidly with no thought about, you know, civic engagement or information built into it. So we're going to have to kind of retrofit things into that. And I think all of these individual initiatives are fine. I think what worries me is that I don't see very much on the policy side of these companies about rethinking that very big core concept of, if we are actually now information utilities, what does that mean for us? And I think that they're not necessarily the right people to do the thinking. So we need people in government and we need people in regulation to do that thinking. Now, current administration, no chance that that will happen. I have some hope that somebody will start to think about it in the next administration. But it's a really, I think, very difficult long-term problem. You know, perhaps the best news of all of this is that we're all on the same page and we're all talking about the same things. You know, the platforms are no longer denying that they don't have any agency in this world. There is no longer this fantasy, frankly, perpetuated that if only newsrooms tried a bit harder or a bit more innovative, that they could, you know, kind of make a business out of this. Look, there's all sorts of things wrong with the legacy press, and there's a lot of local newsrooms, frankly, that we wouldn't want to rebuild in the way that they were built before. But we do have a generational opportunity here, I think, to make things better. But I don't think we can do it without some very, very structural things happening, which enable people to go out and do independent journalism and be funded for it in a market which is not paid for by advertising and probably not paid for entirely by subscribers either. Because, you know, that just means that there'll be poor areas, there'll be areas which are very sparsely populated where you just, you know, don't have enough people doing the work.
All right. Emily Bell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Will.
One final quick break, and then don't close my tabs. Some of the best things we've seen on the web this week.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip. cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
All right, it's time again for Don't Close My Tabs. April, what tab could you not close this week?
So the tab that I couldn't close this week was a report from CNBC entitled Tesla Cars Keep More Data Than You Think, including this video of a crash that totaled a Model 3. And this is about when Teslas get totaled, their computers often stay intact and go to the car graveyard, the wrecking lot with the car. And there's a ton of data in those computers about the driver that is really, really personal data. And it just shows kind of as our computers turn in, or as our cars turn into computers, and our cars have always been really personal places, that they are surveillance machines as well. I mean, inside this wrecked Tesla where they pulled the computer out, they saw the call history and phone books of 11 different phones that had paired with the Tesla, video footage from inside the car, navigation history, you know, outside cameras, inside cameras. I mean, just a ton of personal information. And it's just like fascinating to me that, you know, we're moving into this kind of dystopian future where you go to a wrecking lot and you can pull out, you know, all of this data about who was in the car. And it's just this diary of the car that, you know, can show it has a lot of evidence in it, in fact. And people want, if you want to opt out of this data collection, you own a Tesla, then you also kind of opt out of updates that go over the air. So it's a fascinating report to just kind of show what these cars with computers in them do, and how we can think about privacy in a car. And, you know, I think even a room, there's even room for kind of targeted privacy legislation just looking at cars if we wanted to take a more piecewise approach rather than just data privacy, you know, sweeping data privacy laws. But really a fascinating report I recommend people take a look at. Will, what tab could you not close this week?
All right. This weekend, Netflix is going to drop a huge new nature documentary series. It's called Our Planet.
Oh.
It's from the same team that did the famous BBC nature documentaries, like Planet Earth. It's produced by Alistair Fothergill, narrated by David Attenborough. And there was a review. I have not watched it yet, I should disclose, but I read a review of it in The Atlantic by Ed Yong, who's one of my favorite science writers. The headline of his review is, Netflix's Our Planet says what other nature series have omitted. And he says that unlike the Planet Earth series, the Netflix series really will not let you forget about how everything you're seeing is being changed by climate change, by deforestation. You watch something amazing transpire on screen, and then they remind you, you know, that this ecosystem is being destroyed, and that, you know, what you've just seen, it might be one of the last interactions of this sort that will be seen because of the destruction of the natural environment. There's apparently a long time-lapse sequence in which you can watch the jungles of Borneo being turned into palm oil plantations and just this huge, vast agricultural monoculture. Yang says that it's actually painful to watch. And so it's a nature documentary that does not gloss over the fact that nature as we know it is disappearing.
So that's something I'm so interested in. There's been a broad criticism of Attenborough's work, even his recent work with the BBC, saying that they go through great lengths to show the natural world as it's supposed to exist, you know, omitting human harms. And so it's fascinating now that we're seeing, you know, the new documentary specifically addressing this. I really look forward to watching this. That's a great tab. Thank you, Will.
Yeah, I'm excited about it too. And I also feel really good that after sort of infamously always doing real downers as tabs on this show, I think I've managed to leave us on one of like the biggest downer tabs of all time. So, you know, sorry for that.
I I think it's right in line with your interests because it's media criticism, and one that is just so important. You know, how do we show the way things were or the way things are or the way things should be when it comes to documenting the natural world? Critical question, and one that we really need to pay attention to as the natural world is disintegrating. And I think that does it for our show and Will's last show with us this week. I will miss you, Will. You can email us still, though, even though Will will not be getting the emails, ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, or just say hello.
Yes, I'm going to miss doing this so much. You can follow me in April on Twitter as well. I'm at Will Arimus. April is at April Laser.
Thanks again to our guest, the inestimable Emily Bell. You can find her on Twitter at Emily Bell. And thanks so much to everyone who's left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use to listen. We really appreciate your time in doing so.
If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America.
If you want more of Slate's tech coverage, sign up for the Future Tense newsletter. Every week you'll get news and commentary on how tech advances are changing the world in ways small and large. Sign up at slate.com/future news. Our producer is Cameron Drews, and thanks to Topher Roof for engineering here in UC Berkeley.
And normally this is where we'd say, we'll see you next week. I won't see you next week, but April will, and I bet it's going to be a great show.
Will, you are missed already. You will be missed more when you're fully gone. Folks, please continue to follow Will on Twitter and follow his forthcoming work in Medium that should be starting mid this month. Bye, everybody.